This is Just In Case It Matters, the podcast that tries to have a little class. I'm Dan Liebarger. We're going to be discussing Hunter S. Thompson's influential 1970 essay, The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved.
Incidentally, Mark Twain said that a classic is a book which people praise and don't read. With Thompson's work for Rolling Stone magazine and other outlets, however, that simply isn't the case. Even though he died in 2005, his writing can be found in most libraries or bookstores in this country. At my local Barnes & Noble, for example, there are about 30 or 40 books by or about him. Three Hollywood movies, Where the Buffalo Roam, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and last year's The Rum Diary, have been adapted from his books. Even if you buried yourself in a cave, something Thompson slammed out on his typewriter might find its way to you. With The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, however, it's a little surprising that this piece has lasted. It originally appeared in the June issue of Scanlon's Monthly, a magazine that ran for only 9 issues. It also violated some of the most basic rules of sports journalism. Here's Oscar winner Tim Robbins reading a passage from the new CD of the Derby essay from Paris Records. Thompson's language, which was sometimes profane, and his decisions on what to emphasize were unique.
We went back to the clubhouse to watch the big race. When the crowd stood to face the flag and sing My Old Kentucky Home, Stedman faced the crowd and sketched frantically. Somewhere up in the boxes, a voice screeched,
"Turn around, you hairy freak!"
The race itself was only 2 minutes long, and even from our super status seats and using 12 power glasses, there was no way to see what was really happening. Later, watching a TV rerun in the press box, we saw what happened to our horses. Holy Land, Ralph's choice, stumbled and lost his jockey in the final turn. Mine, Silent Screen, had the lead coming into the stretch, but faded to fifth at the finish. The winner was a 16-1 shot named Dust Commander. Moments after the race was over, the crowd surged wildly for the exits, rushing for cabs and buses. The next day's courier told of violence in the parking lot. People were punched and trampled. Pockets were picked. Children lost. Bottles hurled. But we missed all this, having retired to the press box for a bit of post-race drinking.
Not many sports writers emphasize the bar tab they ran up doing a story. By the way, you've just heard the only paragraph in an article that runs over 7,000 words that actually deals with the 1970 race itself. Thompson and Ralph Stedman, the British cartoonist who accompanied him, had other priorities. After chronicling the Hells Angels motorcycle gang, Thompson returned to his hometown of Louisville and wound up creating a whole new genre in the process.
You know, Warren Zevon used to say a lot of Hunter's best writing is about bad travel. And a lot of the Derby pieces about the difficulty we get. I just went to South by Southwest, and I could have done a, you know, how it's just difficult to get credited, to go see the bands, to get your passes to go see them, to go in a waiting room, to go. So by the end of it, you could do a Fear and Loathing at South by Southwest. It's kind of a formula in its own way, and it started developing that Hunter would use, and it developed with the Derby piece.
That's Douglas Brinkley. He's edited collections of Thompson's work, like The Proud Highway and Fear and Loathing in America. In addition to being the first time that Hunter Thompson had teamed up with Ralph Stedman and his eerie, energetic drawings, The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved was also where Hunter Thompson decided to offer something more entertaining and even more substantial than scores and stats.
Well, he's been doing a lot more straight journalism, freelancing for the National Observer, and I'm doing pieces for the New York Times and the Times Magazine and many other outlets. So when he got the opportunity to write about his home state of Kentucky and also to write about sports with the Derby, which had always been of interest to him as a local Louisville boy, everything kind of gelled for him. He was able to put his ribald humor into the piece. He had Ralph Stedman on board to illustrate. and he was able to have enough word count to, write in what's ostensibly a short story, and it became a cult phenomenon.
When you read or listen to Thompson's take on the Derby, you won't learn which horse placed or even showed. Thompson loves describing how he viewed what he covered through a haze of intoxicants, but in listening to The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, you'll learn more about the discord that ran through 1970 America than you would in a more conventional piece of journalism.
In the air-conditioned lounge, I met a man from Houston who said his name was something or other, and he was here to get it on.
But just call me Jumbo. I'm ready for anything, by God. Anything at all. Hey, what are you drinking?
I ordered a margarita with ice, but he wouldn't hear of it.
No. What the hell kind of drink is that for the Kentucky Derby time? What's wrong with you, boy? God damn, we got to educate this boy. Get him some good whiskey.
Okay. A double old fits on ice.
Ah. Look, I know this Derby crowd. I come here every year, and let me tell you one thing. I learned this is no town to be giving people the impression you some kind of faggot. Not in public, anyway. Shit, they'll roll you in a minute, knock you in the head, and take every goddamn cent you have.
I thanked him and fitted a marble into my cigarette holder.
Say, you look like you might be in the horse business, am I right?
Nope, I'm a photographer.
Oh, yeah? Is that what you got there, cameras? Who you work for?
Playboy.
Well, goddamn, you gonna take pictures of naked horses? Ha! I guess you'd be working pretty hard when they run a Kentucky Oaks. That's a race for fillies. Hell yeah. And they'll all be naked, too.
I shook my head and said nothing. Just stared at him for a moment, trying to look grim. There's gonna be trouble. My assignment is to take pictures of the riot.
What riot?
I hesitated, twirling the ice in my drink. At the track, on Derby Day, the Black Panthers. Don't you read the newspapers? The grin on his face had collapsed.
What the hell are you talking about?
Well, maybe I shouldn't be telling you. But hell, everybody else seems to know. The cops and the National Guard have been ready for 6 weeks. They have 20,000 troops on alert at Fort Knox. They've warned us. All the press, the photographers, who wear helmets, special vests like flak jackets. We were told to expect shooting.
No!
His hands flew up and hovered momentarily between us, as if to ward off the words he was hearing. Then he whacked his fist on the bar.
Those sons of bitches! God almighty, the Kentucky Derby? No, Jesus. That's almost too bad to believe.
Now he seemed to be sagging on the stool, and when he looked up, his eyes were misty.
Why? Why here? Don't they respect anything?
It's not just the Panthers. The FBI says busloads of white crazies are coming in from all over the country to mix with the crowd and attack all at once from every direction. They'll be dressed like everybody else, you know, coats and ties and all that. But when the trouble starts, well, that's why the cops are so worried. He sat for a moment, looking hurt and confused and not quite able to digest all this terrible news.
Oh, Jesus, what in the name of God is happening in this country? Where can you get away from it?
Not here. Thanks for the drink, and good luck. He grabbed my arm, urging me to have another, but I said I was overdue at the press club and hustled off to get my act together for the awful spectacle. At the airport newsstand, I picked up a courier journal and scanned the front page headlines. Nixon sends GIs into Cambodia to hit Reds. B-52s raid. Then 20,000 GIs advance 20 miles. 4,000 U.S. troops deployed near Yale as tension grows over Panther protest. At the bottom of the page was a photo of Diane Crump, soon to become the first woman jockey ever to ride in the Kentucky Derby. The photographer had snapped her, stopping in the barn area to fondle her Mount Fathom. The rest of the paper was spotted with ugly war news and stories of student unrest. There was no mention of any trouble brewing at a university in Ohio called Kent State.
That was Tim Robbins from the new album of The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, joined by Mac Rebinac, a.k.a. Dr. John, playing Jimbo. You can't really discuss Thompson without discussing this piece. Alex Gibney,
The Oscar-winning documentarian who directed Gonzo, The Life and Work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, explains why he devoted a good portion of Gonzo to the Kentucky Derby is decadent and depraved.
Well, I think, for one, it's kind of an origin story. I mean, the Kentucky Derby is decadent and depraved is really the first flowering of Gonzo journalism. I mean, there are some hints of it in Hell's Angels, but this is really Gonzo in full bloom. So that's why I felt I had to have it. The other reason was that there are just some magnificent drawings of it by Ralph, and also that experience. You know, that was the moment where Hunter kind of introduces Ralph into this world, and it just seemed like the beginning of it all.
The term Gonzo became Thompson's trademark. It's the title of a 1960 song by New Orleans organist James Booker, and the word is Cajun slang for playing unhinged. But what exactly is Gonzo journalism? Douglas Brinkley explains.
Well, it's trying to capture the wild essence of something. You know, it's not a stickler for facts, although there's always factual aspects, hardcore factual aspects to a Gonzo journalism. It's putting yourself into the piece, first-person journalism. It's taking the reader on a wilder side. Hunter used to think there's no such thing as paranoia. It's worse than you think. And so to show people just how strange and bad, and then the Derby piece, just how decadent the fan base was, the racism at the Kentucky Derby. And you do that by doing illustration, you illustrate it by having a conversation that never happened about the Black Panthers at the Louis Barraville Airport. Well, that's a false story that never occurred. The net effect of it is to shine a light on a kind of mental attitude of the Jim Crow Kentucky of that era.
Wait a second. You mean that Thompson didn't really annoy that smug bigot in the airport? While Mike Daisy, the author of The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, was recently forced to admit that some of the material from his monologue didn't come from first-hand observations, Brinkley explains how looking for specific facts in Thompson's essay is really missing the point of it.
No, of course, and that's a very, very real scene Hunter's painting there. That's, the problem, and it's not a problem, it's the joy of Hunter's writing, I should say. It's just people keep trying to decipher what's fact and what's fiction, and it's kind of a waste of time. It's a Hunter Thompson book, and Hunter, as an artist, are allowed to do use different ones. I mean, he ended up getting art out of all of this, and that's the main thing. But how you categorize it is what's interesting. There's more truth in the Kentucky Derby piece than there is in most journalism of that era.
Another interesting thing about the Derby piece is that while Thompson managed to find a lot of humor at the expense of the crowd there, he saved some of the most pointed barbs for himself. Here's Alex Gibney.
Well, he writes everything in first person, and so that also takes some of the, or that gives the piece its humor, because he's the undependable, the ultimate undependable narrator, and it's his self-mocking style which makes you trust him, because it doesn't seem like he's looking down on them from a very high place. That's where he also gets a lot of his comedy. He doesn't separate himself out from the swamp. He admits that he's knee-deep in it.
So if Thompson, who gleefully described macing innocent bystanders, is the ultimate unreliable narrator, I thought it would be interesting for Douglas Brinkley to compare Thompson to the subject of his own recently finished biography of the most trusted man in America, the late Walter Cronkite of CBS News. Brinkley's answer surprised me.
Similar. I mean, Hunter was very close to Cronkite. In fact, Charles Carolta, CBS, had paid Hunter's rent for when he wrote The Hell's Angels. And Hughes Rudd, Hunter corresponded with a lot of... He was sort of... Ed Bradley became one of Hunter's great friends. Hunter was in with the Boys Club at CBS, and Cronkite was like the grand poobah. Donner was the CBS guy. In fact, there's a letter he wrote to Walter Cronkite during the Grenada invasion of 83 when Cronkite was retired but was demanding the freedom of the press and that the press be given access in Grenada. Cronkite had become sort of a spokesperson for the Fourth Estate. Hunter admired him a lot, and he uses the Cronkite broadcast as a device in the Vegas book, with Cronkite showing reporting from Vietnam on the news. When Cronkite dissented on the Vietnam War in 68, that always meant a lot to Hunter that, you know, we had Walter Cronkite on our anti-war side.
Because the Kentucky Derby is decadent and depraved, has historical value, as well as sick humor, only someone who shares Thompson's go-for-broke attitude could produce the new recording. Hal Willner has produced anthologies of the music of Kurt Vile, Charles Mingus, and even Disney films. He also happens to be friends with cartoonist Ralph Steadman, Tim Robbins, and others who worked on the album. It turned out that he and I have been fans of Thompson's work for a long time.
Well, honestly, I believe I read it in The Great Shark Hunt first time. I think a lot of people did that didn't know. I think it was the first time it was printed outside of Scallons. I was lucky enough to be old enough, high school or whatever I was, to, I did come across the Hell's Angels book when I was like 12. I went to a camp and there was a guy in the bunk who wanted to be a Hell's Angel when he grew up, and taught us all about them, and that Hunter Thompson book came out around that time. And of course I picked it up and just found the dirty parts. It's just the kind of projects that I'm completely drawn to, which are unlike anything else that's ever been done. And risky. It could be like the greatest records ever. It could be, you know, a disaster.
After talking with Willner and doing all the other research I had done on this project, there was still a nagging question in my head. How much of what Thompson had written is really applicable to going to see the Derby? Nobody else I had talked to had actually been there. And then I remembered. My girlfriend Carmen actually went to Churchill Downs last year. So I twisted her arm a little bit and got her to talk a little bit with me about what was it like to actually be in the Derby. And the funny thing is, 41 years later, very little had changed.
Okay, now, you actually went to the Derby yourself last year. How did your experience going there match up with Hunter Thompson's?
Oh, well, the first thing that you notice is we went there the day before on the Kentucky Oaks Day, and it was kind of nice because it, like, gave us a dry run for what the next day would be like. And we noticed you could not see the racetrack. We were sitting on benches, but everybody around us would, like, stand up on the benches, and there were, like, tall men and ladies with high heels on and hats, and so you couldn't see anything. So that was disappointing that we had spent all that time and money and didn't get to see the race.
So Hunter Thompson's experience with being unable to see the race pretty much matched your own?
Yes, that is true.
No kidding. And on Derby Day itself, did you see anybody who looked sort of like those Ralph Steadman drawings I showed you?
No, I did not, and I didn't see any vomit anywhere, but it was definitely a madhouse. Trying to get out of there was even worse than, you know, trying to get in, because people would come when they wanted to, but everyone wanted to leave at the same time, and we didn't know where we were supposed to go, and people were asking if they were in the right lines and things like that. And
the funny thing was, you were sober while all this was going on.
Yeah, it might have been more fun if we had been drinking. Actually, my mom and I did have a sip of the mint juleps, which were just as disappointing as the race. It was pretty much tasted like pure alcohol with a stick of mint in it. So,
oh, that's awful.
But we did get to keep the commemorative glass.
Well, if Hunter Thompson could walk away from the Kentucky Derby with one of the finest pieces of writing he ever produced, I think Carmen's entitled to a commemorative glass. Anyway, that's about it for this edition of Just in Case It Matters. I'm deeply grateful to a lot of people who helped me on this. Particularly, I should thank Kurt Nishimura, Hal Wilner, Danielle McCarthy, Jackie Lewis, Alex Gibney, Douglas Brinkley, Dave Nickel, Bill Pryor, and of course, my beloved Carmen. Thank you for sharing your insights and for sharing your life with me. I'm deeply grateful. Incidentally, the music you're hearing in the background comes from my nephew, Jackson Liebarger. This broadcast is copyright 2012. Thank you very much for listening.